November 6th of this year will be the 20-year mark for the debut of 24. And we don't want to let that year go by without starting to talk about it and the impact it's had. It is an honor and a thrill to welcome to the show today, director Leslie Hope. Thank you for being a part of this conversation.
Thank you so much for asking me. I'm really pleased to be here. I didn't realize until you just said it that November 6th was the day, or I've forgotten it. It's my mother's birthday.
She's not really
alive anymore, but it's so nice to think that that's connected to my mom in some way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that is it was pushed back from what I've understood from September because of what happened that September. So
that's right.
It is very interesting to think about it. I remember there were a couple of things I was looking forward to as far as TV. I'm a person that I don't like to necessarily have my phone or my computer next to me when I'm watching a movie or watching TV. Yeah. But I do like to have IMDb available, because every once in a while, my wife will look at me and say, where do we know that person from? Where have I seen that person from? So I try to keep that on because I'm like, I know that person from somewhere.
Right.
But I remember I was looking forward to two things. One was a movie called Donnie Darko that was scheduled to come out in September of that year. And didn't get a wide release because it featured a plane crash, and it was supposed to release in September. And then there was 24, which I knew of because I'd heard Kiefer was part of it. Yeah. But I also had heard Stephen Hopkins?
Yeah.
Was a part of the initial part of the show. And I knew his name from directing the Lost in Space movie.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very cool. So there were in a myriad of times when there's so many shows and there's so much being released every single day, I look for things like, who's the showrunner? Okay, I want to know who's the directors, who's involved in this, because I don't want to get into a show. And again, this is first world problems. I don't want to get into a show and then go, oh, it got canceled because the network didn't put enough effort into promoting it or whatever. So I do look for showrunners. Having said all that, the reason I want to start with a thank you today is because as I was preparing for this show to talk to you today, I was going through a lot of the stuff that you've done. And one of the names that came up was Snowpiercer.
Yes.
So Snowpiercer is one of those shows that came up and it immediately goes to my Netflix queue. I'm going to watch that. I don't know when, but I'm going to watch it. And then I watched the episode that you directed and I saw what you'd done. I was intrigued by that story, but also Graham Manson.
Yes.
I'm a huge Orphan Black fan. Okay, loved Orphan Black.
I'm just representing the it's all roads lead to me, it appears.
I'm convinced, having spent the last couple of days rewatching some of this stuff and then watching some of the stuff that I hadn't seen, like Snowpiercer and Lost in Space, that you need your own 6 degrees game.
Well, let me just give you another one. There is Akiva, who wrote that version of Lost in Space that Stephen Hopkins directed, who I met all those years ago at Stephen's place, is my boss on Star Trek. They're coming together.
I have 6 degrees on my notes right here because I went, boy, I watched, one of the things I rewatched was the season of Slasher that you were on.
Right.
And all I can say is, without spoiling anything, you got me twice because I didn't remember how that played out. But I remember watching that and going, oh, I recognize Sebastian from Being Erica, who also some of the other characters were from Being Erica. Okay, I'm in Windsor, right across the border from Detroit. And I don't want to disparage Canadian TV when I was a kid, but all my friends in Detroit, I went to school over there, they all thought Canadian TV was the Beachcombers. And I don't want to.
It was at the time.
I don't want to disparage the Beachcombers by any stretch. I don't want the Beachcombers crowd to come after me.
Listen, it's a testament to a well-made show that had real legs. We should all be so lucky to have that kind of longevity.
Absolutely, but I mean, you've been a part of bringing all TV, making it better. Okay, so that when I watch Lie Exposed, and I see. And I go, I recognize that person, because I've seen them in productions over the last several years. That is the change from the Beachcombers being all that Canadian TV represented to my American friends to Orphan Black, to all the other shows that are, either shot in Canada or started in Canada. So I appreciate that.
Well, I got a bunch of stuff on my I'll throw at you with all that stuff that you said. So
yeah.
I think perhaps part of the 6 degrees and coincidence and overlapping of people is simply the fact that I haven't died yet. You know, I've been doing it for a long time. I've been in the business for 40 years. So you're going to overlap and collide with people again and hopefully work with the people that you like and that like you. So that's sort of part one. But part two, and I'm so happy that you mentioned Lie Exposed and the Canadian part of that, which is to say, if I may, it's a small movie that was produced by myself and Tina Vakalopoulos. And it was a gathering of our pals that, you know, were willing to basically work for nothing and responded so deeply to the material by Jeff Kober and wanted to work with Jerry Chikariti, the director. But and we paid everybody, but I mean really like sandwich money. And I will tell you, in Canada, because many of us had already moved to the States or worked in the States and come back, whatever. But I suppose there was, I don't even know how to describe it, like this American association with us. We were very proudly Canadian and making and very proudly shooting it here in Toronto, a little bit in L.A. We literally, you know, got in our friends and family's houses. I mean, it was like that. It was a real homemade thing. Anyway, the tenor of the reviews that we received in Canada was largely along this line. Who do they think they are? Canadian actors can't act.
Really?
And we don't want to see tired old Canadian actors. It's like, I was so sadly reminded. These are Canadian reviews. So I was really, really sadly reminded about how we don't honor our own here. And it was really important to me that I exposed to the beginning of making these smaller movies in Canada with Canadians and certainly with Canadian crews who are excellent about stuff that I care about that matters to me. It's at a small enough budget that it's not going to kill anybody if it doesn't make a kajillion dollars. Anyway, that's a long wind up to say, you know, we have this association with Canadian TV or Canadian filmmaking or Canadian art, really, that's somehow considered less than our American neighbors. And it, can I swear? I was going to say, it's just bullshit.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Bullshit.
It is, absolutely. It's complete bullshit. Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I really take issue with now that I'm back, you know, I go back and forth. But as a younger person, I was left to Canada when I was 18. So I spent the bulk of my career down in the States. I'd come back to work and stuff. But I really didn't get a place here till maybe six, seven years ago where I was also based here. So I really came back as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe that I'd heard about it, but I could not believe the contempt and disdain that the Canadian reviewers, and not just for our thing, but they seem to take almost a pride in taking down their own. And in particular, there's a couple of actors in Lie Exposed that I think are excellent, and they were singled out. It just makes me so upset. I don't give a shit about the rest of it. It's like, I want people to see the movie. I'm proud of the movie. I don't need a reviewer to tell me the movie's good. But the tenor of it was so, all of them, like they were also unoriginal in being mean about Canada or Canadian actors, as the case may be. That's my soapbox.
Wow.
But the movie's good. Right. Watch it.
And towards this movie in particular.
Yeah, I think.
It was what you found.
You know, I think there's that. And I was talking to a girlfriend of mine the other day about it. And I was like, it's hard for me to discern what the vitriol is about. And I think it, for me, frankly, ultimately, I don't think a lot of people writing reviews anyway, want to see older women not apologize. They don't want to see older women without their clothes on, that's for sure. And they really don't want to see them take complete agency of their life at the expense of a traditional value, I would say, without begging for forgiveness. This is a character who doesn't ask for forgiveness, who says, and she's not living a repressed life or anything. She's just busting out.
Right, right.
Because her circumstances have pushed her beyond ordinary behavior. Anyway, I think that's part of it. But we've also found with Lie Exposed that because it deals also with pornography and art and dying and forgiveness and affairs and alcoholism, all these sort of primary issues, we found in how it's been made that it's a bit of a Rorschach test for people, like how they respond. It's super vivid and super clear, but entirely different from person to person. Nobody agrees on what the movie's about and nobody agrees about what's important in the movie. They're They're committed to the idea. What they think is important is what's important, but everybody's different with it. So that's been really interesting to me watching this play out. Anyway, that's my soapbox. So.
Well, I watched it last night and then I watched it again this morning and I was literally watching the end of it just before I came to set up to record. Yes. And I said, I've got to watch it again later today because I try not to do this often, but the first time last night, I was on my laptop and I went, closed it, put it down. And I like my phone there just for IMDb. Right. And I literally put everything away because I went, the note I wrote was conversations that we'd all like to avoid.
Yes.
And I wrote, because the scene in the park with the couple, and she says, and I wrote, his responses were, give me, why don't you give me this? Why would you don't make me feel special. You don't make me feel appreciated. And it was all me. And I went, and I didn't catch that yesterday. Like I caught it today and I went, oh, he is totally like you need to make me feel good. This is all about me. And she says, this is how you make me feel. And this is how I feel when I see this on your computer. And I went, that is a conversation that could happen in households right across the world that we would rather just avoid for sure.
Yeah. And, I think we're also, I think it's also what I've found. And again, this is my own Rorschach sort of personal association with it. You know, it's this, my son is 28. So I raised a boy who was growing up with this sort of ready access to anything you can imagine he could look at. And it was all just sort of exploding when he was young. And I'm just gonna tell the story about him. He'll kill me, but I'll tell it anyway. I remember that I was, you know, having the talk with him about it. He was probably only 8 or 9, but you had to in household.
You have to,
Because everything was so available. Yep. And the way he sort of described it to me, he was like, you know, take it easy, mom. I actually don't believe, pick a video game. I actually don't believe the Sim characters are real. I don't believe there's dragons. And I don't believe these sort of sword fights that you can recover from, like in my video game. So I don't think that stuff is real either. Meaning he didn't associate them with real human beings, right? Which is almost worse.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a kid, you know, at the time, probably 10 or something. So anyway, this is a long way of saying that this generation that's growing up with it in this way, I think it's, when you can see everything that you want on the internet, anything you can conjure, you can see. And then in our case, we have a movie with, it's just a regular person who's not 20.
Right.
I think it fucks people up. Right. I don't think you want to see that, which I think is awesome. And I think, I'm just very pleased with what we produced and that we were successful in making project work. And I'm looking forward to doing lots of others. But I've been fascinated with the kickback, and I'll loop it back to 24, which is to say 24 was one of the earlier shows that had this kind of internet response. So you could go on the internet when we were doing 24 and see, which was new to me at the time, see like these crazy conspiracy theories, see people weighing in on the characters in a way, see people demanding plot changes, see people figuring it out, really attached to Kiefer. And I this was new for me. So it's not that the internet was new, but this sort of swelling of fan attachment or something was relatively new.
You could have response. Yeah.
Yes, and forums would develop, and people would, you know, teams would sort of form, and you know,
theories.
Analysis of theories, all of that stuff, right?
That was just in the first season, right? Yeah,
that's right, and it's kind of weird to imagine that it didn't really happen that much before. Like now, it's for everything, but at the time, it was kind of a deal. And I can remember watching it and, you know, reading that shit and going like, "Wow, Kiefer!" I was talking to Kiefer about it, who had way more experience than I did dealing with press. You know,
right.
People in that way. And he was like, you've got to fucking stop reading this shit. It was like, I can't believe how into it people are, for good or for bad.
So we're talking about Lie Exposed, the film that you have completed, and I think everybody needs to see, to be honest, because as I said, it's conversations that we all would like to avoid.
Yes.
and there's so many modes of conversations during that film. So in my other life, I practiced law, and then I got out of it almost completely and started going to talk to students and to parents and to teachers about social media. And the approach I take is not, it's scary, get rid of it. It's the end of the world. It's more, how can we use this responsibly? So one of the conversations that's a part of my life and my business in general is the discussions that you're having in this film. The only other film that I can think of that references and talks about porn in a similar way is a movie called Don John, which was done by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, where it was all about a young man who had grown up with the tap. He was able to turn on the tap, and he had this access to everything he wants. And I say to parents, when your kids don't know something, they're going to Google it. And that's a scary thing to do, because you're going to get everything when you your phone, just Google. I was a kid, if somebody said something that I thought was, questionable or dirty, I didn't have a phone in my hand that I could just go, hey, what does that mean? I would just laugh and pretend I knew what they were talking about.
right.
and now you have a full library that will show you images and everything else. And that's a terrible place to be. Yeah. It's certainly, these are conversations that a lot of times parents don't want to have. Parents don't want to know what their kids are doing when the door is closed and the computer screen is on.
Yeah.
So I think inviting this conversation at any point is extremely important. Certainly the character in the movie was an older man.
Yeah. And I think it's important for grown-up people to have the conversation amongst themselves. Right. I'm not talking about divulging your privacy as much as it's about, the thing that I really, this is sort of separate from the thematics of the movie, but I spent quite a bit of time in Cambodia, and I work with an organization there called Friends International. I did a small documentary with them called What I See When I Close My Eyes, which meant I was interviewing some of the street living kids that are supported and protected by this agency called Friends. Anyway, the point of all this is, sex trafficking, sex trade, sex tourism is a massive problem in Cambodia. And the recognition that does not exist, I think, generally for viewers of porn is that, I don't know how to say it, but this basically, they're people. Those are people you're looking at. They're not actors per se. They're, I don't mean that actors aren't people, but it's not a fun game.
They're living, breathing people. Yes.
They're living, breathing people who there's no disparaging here against somebody who chooses that line of work. I don't even talking about that. I'm talking about the situation that I was in, where I was looking at little kids who were in that business. And I was looking at men and women who were just, forget about having a choice. I mean, I was doing some outreach work in a park where if they were lucky, they were making a dollar to blow somebody between on their way home from work or whatever.
And a tourist coming over.
So, I mean, that's the thing that I said, and this is, I don't want to veer this off. It's a whole other discussion.
No.
The people thing. And that was the thing when my son said that to me so many years ago, he's like, it's sort of like a video game. Like he doesn't believe that there's dragons. Like, come on, mom, I don't think dragons are real. And the correlation was, it wasn't really real what he was looking at. Otherwise, actually, newsflash, that's a person.
I've had the same conversation with my kids. It's the idea is, this is something that will consume your time if you let it. And it will take any dreams that you have and replace your dreams if you allow it to become everything. And it's a different conversation than my parents would have had with me at that point, because there was no tap at that point. There was faucet that would just spew it out. Absolutely.
Anyway, who did you think we'd be talking about porn when you do 20 years of 24?
Well, I mean, again, having watched the movie and understanding, it's certainly what I talk about. It's what I talk about with parents. So yes. No, it's very interesting. And honestly, I mean, some of the other conversations that I appreciated in that film, where they finally somebody talked about why Tarzan's monkey was called Cheetah. I've waited 52 years to hear that, and somebody finally acknowledged, isn't that weird? But that was, I didn't realize Jeff Kober, who I recognize from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the X-Files and shows like that, actually wrote.
That's right.
That. Wow.
Amazing. Yeah, no, he wrote that. He wrote that movie. It was based on a play that he'd written, that he was starting to write scenes in. He was teaching an acting class, and he was starting to write scenes material for some of the actors. And it sort of morphed into a play, which then morphed into the movie itself. And he, of course, plays the photographer. And what's, I think, really special about him, amongst many things, though, is that he does those tintype photographs. That
really?
Process of shooting on tin or aluminum or whatever it might be, that's a really particular and special process for photographers. And he's got his own studio, which is where we shot. And he does those photos. I mean, he does all different kinds of subject matter, but he is becoming a real specialist in tintype photography as a photographer, which is neat.
Yeah. That is neat. And as you've said, this is your swan song for acting.
Yes.
Lie Exposed is it. And you are full-time ongoing director.
That's right.
Tell me about that. Tell me how that came about.
Well, it's been there for a long time, which is to say I directed my first short when I was maybe 18, 19.
Okay.
Shortly after I moved to LA. And I'd moved to LA as an actor to work on a Cassavetes film called Love Streams. And that was a great thrill and privilege. And I was so smitten with him and how he worked and what he did. I think I thought at the time that I would just be able to kind of find my way into directing too, or making stuff at least. And acting seemed a relatively easy conduit for me at the time. It was the early 80s. I looked a certain way. I'd probably get an audition. Like, it wasn't,
sure.
It was a little, now I think it's much harder, but at the time it was relatively easy to kind of fall into consideration as an actor. But I, frankly, it wasn't my dream. My trajectory, I'd hoped, was that I'd be making stuff and I
creating.
Didn't. Yeah. I didn't get that it was going to be harder for someone who looked like me, which is to say a girl. Yeah. That's changed a little bit over the past years. But at the time, I sort of banged my head against the wall a little bit. So I just made my own stuff. I continued to act. I did my own stuff on the side. I ran a couple different theater companies, produced and directed there, did documentaries, did shorts. And the whole time I was in the acting game, I was like, how do I get out of this? And
sure, right. So it's been a lot of, you've taken some amazing roles. I'm going to recommend.
And I've been very fortunate to work with extraordinary directors. Stephen Hopkins, one of my favorites, one of the guys from 24. The story about that was I actually was up in Toronto about to direct a movie, I thought, based on a play that I acted in. I wasn't going to act in the movie, but it was a play that we'd done with my theater company. And I don't know, we were days away from starting to do real prep. And we had Mark Harmon and Wendy Crewson, and I want to say Molly Ringwald or Cyndi Lauper, some weird spread, one or the other at the time. And we had the money, great. And the money got yanked. And I was so bummed that my manager, Perry, at the time said, well, you should go back to LA and you should audition for this job. And I was like, I don't want to audition for a stupid job. I don't want to act. I want to be directing. But, just try. I mean, just get your head out of this space. It was like, this is dumb. This whole thing is dumb. And when I auditioned for it, I hadn't even read the script. I just had the scenes.
Wow, and, really?
And I really liked Hopkins, Stephen, in the room. But I didn't really know what I was reading because all the elements of the ticking clock and how that show was shot, that was not in the page. That was introduced by Hopkins. So it was on the page.
I did not know that.
Yeah, right. So if you take away that, think about that. Like, if you took away the ticking clock and the divided screen, and you took away that music, which is extraordinary. And okay, that really, Kiefer's Kiefer's amazing, but let's just say you took away these sort of key definitions of what that show was. It's not as extraordinary on the page as it became in its execution, right?
No.
You're in this case.
You know what it was for me? Mm-hmm. It became a film. Yeah. It wasn't a TV show anymore.
Yeah.
My story on that was I had some friends that said, you got to watch the show 24. And I said, okay. So I literally one night dropped in the middle of it. The first person I saw on the screen was you, and you had amnesia. Okay.
Sorry, buddy.
So that was the first time I saw it. And I went, clearly this isn't a show I can just drop in the middle, like a SVU or something like that. This is a show where I have to watch from the beginning. So I waited again in those days, no Netflix. I waited until Rogers Video had where you could rent it, which is no more. You could rent the season. So I rented the first two discs. I took them back to my apartment. I was pretty newly divorced at that point. So I had spare time. My kids, half the time.
Yeah.
So I had the time. And so I took the two discs home. I got through the middle of the second disc. I took it back to Rogers Video well before it was supposed to be returned. And I drove to Walmart to buy the set because I was like, there's no way. There is no way I cannot own this. You know, in the days before binging and everything else, I have to own this. And that was my experience with 24. I went, this is not TV anymore. This is a film that I'm following. And again, exactly what you said, the split screen, the ticking clock, all that kind of stuff. I thought that was pretty powerful stuff, to say the least.
I did too. And I'll tell you, like, my experience of it was, so of course I love Kiefer. We actually have quite a few Canadians on that show. Which you probably Right. So Mia Kirshner and Alicia in the first season. And we did the pilot, and this is sort of how the game goes, right? You do the pilot, you wait how many months to find out if you're gonna get picked up. And so we get picked up. We're only, as far as we know, we haven't been picked up for a full 24 episodes. The show's called 24, but we've only got 13. right?
Very optimistic, right?
Right. So exactly. So we're like making it like every other actor on a gig like that. You're like hopeful, but whatever, we're making the thing. But we were having a wonderful time, and I loved Hopkins, and I just adored Kiefer, and I really did truly enjoy the acting part of that, which doesn't happen all the time, especially since, you know, I was like me, all pouty about my movie not going. So so I remember they brought us together at lunch to screen the pilot. So now we're probably in shooting episode 2 or 3 or something, and I knew that I liked everybody that I was working with, and the crew was exceptional on that show, but you don't know what you got until you saw, especially with the overlays of that split screen stuff. And so I remember watching it. I'll never forget it, actually, like going, oh, fuck, this is good.
That was my reaction too.
I was like, wow, it didn't change our approach, I think, to how we were acting or executing for my own self anyway. But to know that we were in bigger, better hands for me than I'd had been of late, I was excited. And I already adored Hopkins so much, Stephen Hopkins so much. And I just thought he was such a smart and funny person. To then see his successful execution of this pilot made me really excited for him too. So that's a long wind up to say. I remember seeing it as well. And then as the show went, I mean, you're probably hep to all this, but at the time, again, internet was, I sound like I'm 1,000, but the internet notion was sort of new.
No. It was all new.
Yeah. Binge watching was new, right? So that you couldn't binge watch. So we all knew at that point, the critics said good stuff too, like that the show was good, or we thought it was, but the numbers weren't high. It wasn't like tons of people were watching it. It was sort of this growing thing, but it wasn't like a hit out of the gate. And so much so that we got to episode 13 and we didn't know if we were going to be doing the back nine or 24 episodes. We thought we might be called 13, right? Because we didn't get the official pickup. So you can see in the show, if you know, at the end of 13 episodes, there's like a almost finale, just in case we don't get the back nine, which is like a helicopter rescue or something, right? But we were sort of, what they started to do was air it. It was on Fox, but started to air it on FX, which was like a new kind of upstart cable at the time.
Right.
And then they put it out in DVD in the summer. And it was the DVD, people like you who bought those DVDs, where the show just kind of went kaploo, you know? But it wasn't, we were very fortunate in a way that we didn't have a lot of oversight. The studio was cheap and far away from the stages were far away from the studio. So nobody wanted to drive to come boss us around. Like we were way the frick out there and hassle to come. So we were just by ourselves with no executives. That's what I remember.
Yeah.
Nobody overlooking us, just making the show. It was so much fun. So much fun.
Not the norm. That wasn't not the norm all. Is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it's one of those things too, that I rewatched the finale of season one earlier today. I watched the last 20 minutes, which are devastating. And I remember I got to the end of the DVD set. And so I still had the summer to wait until season two started. And I remember going into season two saying, well, they're going to bring her back. Well, clearly she's going to come back. But my love for film, I love that there's a movie called 12 Monkeys, Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt. The first time in my life, I sat in a theater and at the end of the movie, I don't know if you remember the ending, the crowd just sat there. Like nobody got up and moved right away. We were all just like, what did we just witness? The very the ending of that, it didn't answer hardly anything. Right. And it didn't give us a satisfying ending, but it was just like, I remember sitting in that going, I like this feeling. And as much as it was hard to watch you go, and even today it was hard to watch you go, it was like, boy, that went somewhere that I didn't see it coming. There was no understanding that was where it was going to go. And it was like, wow, this show it had proven over the first season how different it was. But that was a moment where I was like, oh, they are that different. They are willing to go there. And it's the only, actually, I don't know if you know this, it's the only episode that actually had flashbacks of the whole series. Because everything was just going through. But there were two flashbacks from the first episode, from the pilot episode that came back at the end. Right. And then he's just left there holding you, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things that you noted, we talked before, you said that you considered to be a small role on the show 24. I have a theory that your role was huge on the show 24 because the effects of that moment carried through the other eight seasons, in my humble opinion.
Well, that's,
Again, I don't assume that you watched further after season one, but I did. And there is an episode, it is the very end of season three, where everything catches up to Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, because he comes in season two, I don't remember, he comes in season two hard and broken. And the only way he came in broken was because of what happened at the very end of season one. But there's an episode at the end of season three where he's sitting in his car and the day is over and he just loses it and he starts crying. And I was like, this is a three season buildup of that moment. I've actually shown that to men's groups to say, let it go. Don't be afraid to, you know, like he's carrying literally the weight of the world on his shoulders. But the only reason he was carrying it is because he regretted the decisions he made with you.
Well, let me say this, that impact is not, this is not false. I'm saying this, that impact is not because of me. That's because of Kiefer's acting and that right. So Kiefer's an extraordinary performer, of course, but he carried that for three seasons. He's the one who did that with the writing and of course the directors and producers. And the impact is because he's, as the performer, showing you what the impact is or experiencing the impact for the audience to understand what that character is going through. I'm happy to take a compliment, but
absolutely.
That's actually not mine to take. It is the level of performance that Kiefer can do. I mean, here's where I will say is real life, my personal fondness for Kiefer, and I understand his, for me, that was genuine. And I could maybe say, maybe if he had a really rough day at work and it was really hard for him to feel like acting, that maybe he might reach back and remember that we were actually, you know, we had been pals in that first season, but that would be the extent of it. But other than that, he's just, that's his work. And the ongoing people who carried the torch of that show. But having said all that, it was wild, man. Like you didn't kill pregnant wives of the heroes on TV at the time.
Right, no.
You didn't kill them by stabbing them or shooting them in the pregnant guts, right? Like you didn't do that. And right.
Yeah.
I think that was pretty great that they did. And we, even Kiefer at the time when the news first came down, what they were going to, we shot it three ways. We didn't know actually what they were going to do until it aired. But he said in the beginning, he was like, if she dies, meaning the character, I'm a loser. Like my character's a loser. And who wants to watch a loser? Which is a new idea in TV. Like, and you know, I've spent the whole season like trying to be, and then I fail. So now not something that can carry into. And of course we all, that was sort of traditional thinking that we all kind of were like, yeah, at the time, but man, did they make the right decision? I think it was excellent what they did.
That's amazing. Even though your job was done and you didn't come back in the second season, you still think they made a good call.
Oh, they did. Of course they did. I mean, look, I had a great time on that show. I consider it a personal and professional highlight, like really of my career. But I really, at the end of the day, if I were going to be acting or if I'm going to be doing anything, I want to be part of something good. And what was really great about the show was that. So I can go on and do another acting job at the time. I was going on to other things anyway. So it wasn't, I was sad to leave everybody there.
Right. Yeah.
I loved them and I had a wonderful time, but in terms of the show, there's no question that was the right decision for the show. Of course. Sure. Right. Otherwise, you know what? We wouldn't be talking about it 20 years later.
Exactly. Yes. Right.
20 years.
It would have wrapped it up nicely in a bow at the end of season one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything from 24, from your time on 24, that you took into your directing pursuits?
You know, it's funny, and I'm almost ashamed to tell you the story, but I will. So I did a scene, and it was early on, and it wasn't Hopkins who was directing. It was another director. It might have been Davis. And I might be merging who was directing it, but it was a scene in the barn. It was like around the rapey sort of situation where Silas, whose real name is Silas, where Silas rapes me, or I say, take me, not my daughter. Right.
Right. Yes.
And I have a big sort of emotional, this is how I remember it. I could be wrong because I haven't seen it in 20 years, but I have a big emotional sort of thing with my daughter, either before or after, I can't remember which. And they ended up, cutting it together or shooting it together. So it was really more about the daughter's reaction than the mother's act, you know, than my whatever I had was doing breakdown thing. And I remember saying to Hopkins, cause I felt like friendly with him at that time. And we were felt very collaborative. Like I remember like, why would you do that? I mean, this is the scene about, you know, Terry Bowers having thing. And I'm ashamed that I just think that I did this now. I questioned how they were doing it because I couldn't see. It was really better at the time for the scene that it swung to Alicia. And I was just so stuck in my own, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing all this work if you're not going to photograph it. Like, what a jerk. So now when I come up against that as a director, when I come up against a version of that from actors, I'm pretty quick to say something like, you know, it's not all about you, right? Which Stephen told me that Hopkins told me then. It's like, it's not about you. I mean, you're doing all this to support the scene, but it's actually in his opinion. It's about Alicia, whatever. And I'm sort of mushing the details, I'm sure. But what I can tell you is I was a jerk. Hopkins reminded me that I was a jerk. And I like to think I carry that lesson with me for other actors now. Like, hey man, not about you. Just here to remind you.
Yeah.
And if you're professional, you'll do it anyway. So I learned that. Yeah. And I learned this other thing, which is sort of hard to describe, but you know, there's a lot of things about 24 that I think were special and unique and all that, but there's some kind of special sauce in that show that you can't pay for. like some beautiful magic happened in that particular time in everybody's life. We all landed in that space together in that time on that shitty stage that we were shooting in, which was out of town. So we didn't
come in
and like getting our business. Everybody's time in their life, both Kiefer and I would say at the time, we were both felt super grateful to have a job. And that really colored our dedication to that particular season. And I mean, Kiefer obviously had a much bigger career than me, but at the time, he needed the job the way the rest of us did at the time.
Sure,
So it was kind of infused with this gratitude. And because there was a bunch of us Canadians on it too, it did feel a bit like clubhousey in a good way. Like, oh, cool. Like they let us all in.
They got us all here.
Yeah. For sure.
on Facebook, there's 24 Universe, and I like it. It's discussion about, hey, did you see this show that this person from 24 is now on? So it's like, it's kind of fun. They don't allow any kind of, they really try to discourage any kind of trash talk. But it's just like, hey, let's keep informed on what Roger Cross is doing or what Leslie's doing or whatever. They posted. So Jason Fedak the other day posted a picture of the original picture of the three of you. Kiefer, and Alicia. And it says,
I'm so young.
It says, yeah, it says the all-American family and they're all Canadian. Funny.
Yeah, man.
Which I thought was awesome. I thought that was so
great,
cool.
Great.
You've directed so many different, you've directed sci-fi, drama, action, you know, in the last several years. I'm looking at Lost in Space, looking at Snowpiercer, which is now at the top of my list on Netflix that it wasn't a couple days ago. And then the next thing is Star Trek, which is the story of Christopher Pike, which is interesting to me, only again from the geek level. I'm sorry, I'm geeking out, that Bruce Greenwood that was in Lie Exposed, right? He's brilliant on Resident. I love what he does, but he was Christopher Pike in the movies. And now you're going to direct Christopher Pike's story, which was always kind of a side story to the original thing. What if for you, is there a difference between taking on a brand new show like Emergence, for example, as opposed to going in when you're directing an SVU episode? Is there a difference?
Most definitively for me, there is anyway. So I'm a, not a younger director, but a newer director than many of my colleagues. Perhaps if I'd been directing for 40 years and not, you know, acting for whatever, 25, 30 of them, maybe I would have a little more ease about it. But sure, like Law and Order on the air 20 something years, that's a machine.
Right, yeah.
It's a beautiful, well-oiled constructed machine, but if you know, I go direct Law and Order and I tripped and fell and like broke my neck, that show would keep on going. Like there is no, it goes, you as a director coming into that show, you can maybe shape or add grace notes, but that show is bigger than you will ever be as a director in terms of its how it moves. A show like Emergence or now I'm on Star Trek on Strange New Worlds. Star Trek's not a new idea, but it's a new show.
Right.
So the mechanical sort of hitches in the giddy up for a new show, like when stuff's going to be ready and bringing in new people and people figuring out how they like to work together and what the language of the show is like, all that's developing anew. So it's just more, it's super fun and interesting, but it's, not necessarily as smooth. It's like a little bit like having square wheels for a while. Like you're just going to get the wheels going until the corners wear off and then they'll turn round and then you'll move a little more smoothly. But that being said, it's, you know, say Rah Rah Canada again, we're shooting in Toronto and I'm always happy to be home. And I'm always happy to work with my, you know, fellow Canadian crew and sometimes cast. So that's great. And so it's a long answer to your question to say, yeah, it is different. It would be like, you know, your first year of high school versus senior year, you know, like it's, you just start to get in a groove and things get easier and you know each other better and the show has its smoothness and you know where the light switches are and you know, if you're a visiting director coming back, you know where the bathroom is, like stuff like that, that just takes energy to sort of figure out. So, yeah, and it's exciting to be here on Star Trek on a new season because presumably you get to have a little bit of influence in the development of what it might be, even if it's a tiny bit, that's kind of neato. And yet, you know, there's this, it's sort of like pizza. Like there's really no bad pizza, right? Like it's no bad directing for the most part. It's all pretty cool for me.
It sounds like it excites you. The idea of directing and going into a new show or going into an established show equally excites you.
Oh, great.
What is it excites you? Yeah. What excites you about that?
Well, I mean, for one, I mean, the truth is I've spent my whole life trying to get through this door of making stuff or being around that sort of being around cameras and people and making pictures that talk. I just love all that. And I always have. It just took me a while to get through that door. It doesn't matter why. I'm very happy to be there. I'm very grateful to, I'm 55 years old. I've been in the business, like I said, for 40 years, right? And most people about now are getting a gold watch for retirement after 40 years in a gig, right? And I'm just now in a new phase. That's pretty cool. I'm super excited with the world that I've been in. It's been a lot of phys effects and technical stuff. And it's not a world that I knew very well. So everything's new. Like we're working with, so it's called The Volume, you know, we're on the Star Trek show, which is what they used on Mandalorian, which is that LED projection of backdrop and stuff. That's super cool. I'm talking about geeking out. I'm going to geek a bit on that.
Right.
Yeah. But I really like making stuff. And as an actor, as I got older, certainly, where I ostensibly probably had more to offer, there were less people interested in what I did have to offer. And I think that was aging out. And I was never like a movie star or TV star or anything. So what the fuck do they care what I have to say? So I just found it like, boring and frustrating, but mostly boring. Like I just played this part for the past 3 years on 5 different shows. I could, you know, pick the wardrobe before I get here.
Yeah. I'm 52. And I remember in the mid 80s, there were these, I remember People magazine covers that would show Joan Collins and trying to think of Linda, can't think of her name, the two main characters of Dynasty and Linda Evans. And they, and the headline was always, they're 40 and they're still working. Like it was like, oh my gosh, they can still, it was like, so that was my question is, you know, how that's the 80s to now. Have we moved the needle any more than that kind of astonishment? Oh my gosh.
Well, I Botox and plastic surgery have done wonders for extending the shelf life of some women, I think. There's that, frankly, you know, what we look at. I do think there's been a shift, a cultural shift and sea change driven by the people themselves that say, actually, I'm not ready to be thrown in the trash heap.
Right. Absolutely not.
There's been an opening for material and performance and creation that looked a little different than it did in the 80s. And I'm only aware of it because I just happen to be in the group that's the opportunity is opening for, which is to say females. The age of it all, though, was interesting because I can't speak to the acting of it anymore, except again, you know, what happened with Lie Exposed is like, this is a problem because I'm an old broad. That's what the problem is. That's what people are some people are reacting to. So I think the ageism is a real issue for actresses. That's like a tired old story. We all know that. But in terms of directing, one would presume it's a value add because it typically suggests experience and perhaps a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know something, but
we're seasoned.
Yeah, that's what you would think. And I think that's true to a certain extent. But at the end of the day, my experience of the movie business or TV business is they're always looking for something shiny and new. It doesn't necessarily mean youth, but typically it does. And that's the business, right? That's what it is what's new, what's cool, what's happening. now with this huge amount of material that can be, you know,
that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
The appetite is
so many stations,
right? It's just tons of stuff. Yeah.
Hopefully that means that there's room for more voices that aren't right? white males. Right.
Dude, I'm so over it. And look, I like to say it, some of my best friends are white males.
Me too. I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
Not about that. It's about the homogenousness of it.
Right.
Homogeneity. What is that word that says it's all the same?
Yeah. All yeah, one color.
Yeah. One color, one style, one type, one, what doesn't matter what. It's like, it just gets boring. So yeah. I think the cracking open of it, and look, we're nowhere near being, there's nowhere near parity in terms of representation. I'm interested, right. I'll tell you lately, as much as the ages thing, I'm really interested in disabled performers, disabled creators, disabled directors, like, which is to say that voice really, man, is virtually unheard in TV and film. I mean, when's the last time saw an actor on TV and film that was played by an actor who was actually disabled or actually mentally challenged or actually had special needs? No.
Only one I can think of is Glee. Glee had that's the only one that comes to mind right now.
If we were sitting here talking about and said, well, I can think of one woman who's been on TV, or I can think of one black performer who's been on TV, or one Asian. Right. I mean, and then go, no, it's not that bad. But you go down, you know, to the point of the triangle to go like disabled. Yeah, you can think of one. Me too.
I have a black friend. It's okay. I have a black friend. It's all right.
Right.
You know, it's that mentality that says, I know that's one. Right. I can point to one. So see, we did it. Yeah, we've arrived. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that too, it's like, I mean, I think what I have a friend, Megan Follows, who said, you know, we're talking about the, in particular, there's a fun fact, of the four female actresses in Lie Exposed, three of us, have I got that right? Yeah, three of the five. Me, Gracelyn Kung, Kristen Lehman, and Megan Follows are all directors. Paola, the woman who's from Mexico City, she's a writer. But me, Megan, and Kristen in particular are in the TV circuit. And anyway, Megan and I were talking
about
this.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's neato. She said, you know, I think honestly, if we can just pay everybody the same, that would level the playing field. So, and there was something about that. I was like, oh, yeah. It's perhaps that's the way to make this.
And why is that such a foreign concept still? Like that's, you know, why is that revolutionary?
I don't know, man.
Everybody the same amount that you're going to pay.
Listen, it doesn't, right? But I was just reading yesterday about the fight in down south about raising a minimum wage to 15 an hour. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know that it was under 10. My son works restaurants, and he was barely working, barely getting by on 16 an hour, working full time, working his ass. And he was getting 16 bucks an hour. He could not get by. So I think about, you know, growing up people with families and stuff like that. It's a fucking tragedy and a crime. And I don't know why there's even a fight about it. Like, are you kidding? You're fighting to keep the minimum wage under $10? Go fuck yourself, man. Anyway, that's a whole other thing.
No, and it's one of those things where we say film, it's, you know, is film important? Is it? But in many ways, it can highlight those things. I mean, the first thing you directed was a documentary, right, on the plight in Cambodia. Yeah. So film helps me to educate in Windsor to say, oh, okay, I know a little bit more about that than I did an hour ago. One of the ones that I go back to recently is the show Unbelievable. Unbelievable was a Netflix. I don't know if you saw that one. The story was a woman who was assaulted. Guy crawls into her apartment and sexually assaults her. And the rest of the story is how she's treated by the law. So from a legal standpoint, I'm watching it. And I'll tell you what worked for me as a guy who has never been in that situation. I watched her being interrogated by two police officers. The dynamic was she was sitting here the police officers are sitting here in front of her, two male officers, and the door to get out was at the end of the room. And so I remember film reminding or showing me a perspective that I had never thought of before. She's free to get up and leave. I know that from a legal perspective, but what it's going to take for her to get there, which makes me as a man say, I don't think a man should ever interrogate or should ever question a woman after a sexual assault. I came out of it thinking we can't relate. We don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to do that. Right. But I actually found myself sitting in this situation. It showed me what the perspective was to say, I got to get past these two guys to even leave, even though I know in my head I can leave. That is a barrier for me getting out of here. And so they just browbeat her until she changes her story. It was one of those things where I said, that's the power of film, to show somebody who doesn't understand a perspective to understand it.
Right? Yeah.
And I think that's why it's important that you continue to keep making film, is because you have a perspective that I don't understand, but I need to understand.
Well, let me say that all of us who, you know, I want to see like your story. I want to see my neighbor's story. And it doesn't even occur to me I'm missing it until I see it. Right. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I don't have any rancor towards what that system that's been in place. Not really. It's like, why should my straight white male counterpart look to make a movie about me? He should make his own damn story. That's important.
Sure,
so I can find out, you know, that's what, it's not to say he couldn't do it. It's just like, I think we all sort of, I think everyone should tell their own story, however they see fit, whatever the medium is. It's just making room for all those voices. I think there's plenty of room at the table, you know, I really do.
Like that. That's a great point to end it. There's lots of room at the table. There's lots more ways to get the stories out and to tell the stories that need to be told.
Yeah.
Well, Leslie, I appreciate you taking the time
Thank you so much.
Sit down and have this conversation and share some cool stories about everything that you've done and what you've got ahead, which is very exciting. So thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Really nice talking to you.
Typical barrister.
Works for Jack Bauer.